Hello, America and the world. This is Radio Free Market, and I am your host, Michael McKay. Today we have a wonderful show, folks, with our guest, Mr. Patrick Barron. Pat has been with us before. Welcome, Pat.
Michael, glad to be here.
Now, Pat is a professional banker who has been in banking consulting for the last 20-plus years.
Yes.
And is currently teaching Austrian economics at the University of Iowa and continues to teach at the University of Wisconsin Graduate School in their banking program. So I asked Pat to come on the show. You may remember, folks, that he was here in July because I wanted to talk about personal responsibility, freedom, and money. And today we're going to talk about what we need to unlearn and how can we learn some of the basics about money and why more than ever before this is critical. So this is not a call-in show this week, folks. So if you do have questions or would like to engage Pat or me further on these topics, please email at radiofreemarket.com and we will take care of your question and go from there. Okay. So today we're going to start with, you know, some of the things that we need to unlearn. You know, in this topic of money and economics, people are very lost, Pat. And I find that one of the most pervasive things that people are confused about is this attitude that we see everywhere that people seem to think that they can live off of other people and other people's money. Mm-hmm. You know, How did we get to that kind of thinking?
Well, I think that the root of all evil is not necessarily money or love of money, but the root of all evil is government money, fiat money, paper money, money that is not based in real value, money that is not part of the market process, but money that is forced upon us by the government. Mm-hmm. And over the last almost now 100 years since the Federal Reserve Bank was formed in 1913, so we're coming up here to the 100th anniversary in just 4 years, we have gradually learned that, or the public has gradually come to believe, rather than learn, but come to believe that the government itself is the source of their wealth, is the source of their security, personal security, their economic security, rather than relying upon themselves. And this is a, I think this is a perversion of our thinking that is a consequence of having our money foundation undermined by government fiat paper money. In other words, money that can be produced out of thin air, money that we are forced to use, money that is not a result of the market process and is not a result of production, but money that is just forced upon us and we see this every day, I think. I really am concerned about this. I think that the biggest example we have today, Michael, is the welfare state. Now, in the days of sound money, we can get into later what sound money is, but it's the gold standard. In the days of sound money, this was impossible.
Well, we're going to come back to this, folks, in just a minute. We're talking with Mr. Pat Barron. This is Radio Free Market. And I am your host, Michael McKay. And after a couple of minutes, we'll be back after the break. We're going to be talking more about personal responsibility, freedom, and money. Please stay with us. Thank you very much. This is Radio Free Market, and I am your host, Michael McKay. And with me is Mr. Patrick Barron. And we're talking about personal responsibility and money and freedom. And Pat, we were just talking about before the break this issue of people trying to get something for nothing. There's an old quote from Frederick Bastiat that government is that fiction whereby we all try to live off of everyone else. From an economic point of view, that's just not possible.
No, of course not. And we were talking about my major concern of how money exacerbates this problem that is will always be with us. Government, we will always have government. Government is necessary, in my opinion. So you will always have people that are trying to use the government for their own personal gain, always couching what they want in, of course, altruistic terms for the benefit of the unfortunate or for the benefit of society. But when you have government money and the government controlling the money supply, then it seems as if this really can happen. That, instead of the government being forced to tax my fellow citizens or go into the credit markets and borrow from them in order to give me something, my retirement income or my disability income or farm price support, whatever the case may be, now the government just prints the money. Mm-hmm. And we see this today when the government is spending money. Someone said they spend money not like a drunken sailor, because a drunken sailor actually spends his own money, mm-hmm. whereas the government spends our money. Mm-hmm. But the government's spending money hand over fist, let's say, and yet the interest rates have not gone up. They've driven down the interest rates, and our taxes have not gone up. So, what a wonderful world. Now I think I'll line up at the government trough mm-hmm. to get something for nothing.
Well, let's sort this out. Let's try to sort this out a little bit. You know, government in and of itself it doesn't produce things. It really just redistributes things.
That's right.
And so because it doesn't produce things, how is it that government's use of exclusive use of force, how does that interact with the aspect of life that does produce things? You know, how do the producers and government get together and make this thing into a mess?
Well, the government as the sole use of force, the sole legal entity that can use force in a society, always can force us to do things. But when it gets bigger and government money, our fiat money, allows it to get much bigger, then it has the ability to get into all kinds of areas especially the economy, all kinds of areas of private life that previously were private life. They mm-hmm. were not public life. We see this today in all kinds of things where the government is telling us what we can and we cannot do, what we can eat, what we can sell to a willing public. Some of the things that are just so ridiculous that, but yet people sort of support these things. In my hometown of Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, we now have a trans fat ban.
A trans fat man?
Ban.
Oh, ban.
A ban
okay.
on trans fats. Okay. So this was a big thing maybe a year or so ago where restaurants were forbidden to use trans fats in their frying of food.
Okay.
And, well, in the past, this was ridiculous. People mm-hmm. would have said, well, what's the government doing here? This is not a government issue. This is not protecting my life or my property.
Mm-hmm.
But yet when the government starts down this road of using its power that it gets from spending lots of money, you know, it's got to have inspectors, it's got to have policemen, it has to have people that write the regulations and keep and check up on them and everything. So it has to have lots of money to do all this, and it gets that money by just plain printing it. But when mm-hmm. it starts to do that, well, there's just no end to the mischief that it can wreak mm-hmm. in society.
Well, you know, a lot of people think that we live under a capitalist kind of system, but we don't really.
No.
You know, we live in something that is more which is very different. You know, and some people have called it mercantilism, other people have called it corporatism, but that's really just a partnership between some businesses and government, but not all businesses.
Yeah, we live in what Ludwig von Mises calls the hampered market economy. And the hampered market economy means that we still have generally a market economy. Prices are set for the most part in the market by the interplay of supply and demand. But it is hampered in many ways. It's hampered by regulations, by, one of the biggest regulations that impacts us in so many ways is the minimum wage law.
Mm-hmm.
That causes really terrible unemployment among the people who are most at risk in our society, the people who are less educated for one reason or another, mm-hmm. the people who have fewer skills, they are priced out of the market.
Mm-hmm.
By this regulation, mm-hmm. A minimum wage regulation that says that if you have a business, you cannot hire someone unless you pay them X dollars.
So we're really, the market is really hampered by the interventions of government.
Yes.
And there's a lot of different kinds of interventions.
There's so many.
Just count monopolies, cartels, subsidies, you know, restrictions.
Licenses.
Mandates, licenses, yes, you know, and so on, and all of those. So we don't really have a free market, but do we have? What are some examples of things that we can look at that are more free, that are actually more examples of free market operations?
Well, the governments always love to regulate what they call the commanding heights of the economy.
Mm-hmm.
So you see the government regulating medical care, for example,
mm-hmm.
heavily involved for decades now in medicine, in the regulation of hospitals and clinics and doctors and things.
What did you call that again? The heights?
The commanding heights of the economy.
The commanding heights of the economy. So like medicine and money.
Medicine. Money, steel manufacturing. Actually, it was Lenin that said that he wanted to regulate the commanding heights of the economy. And he really wasn't all that concerned initially, anyway, of what went on with the peasants buying and selling things.
So clothing, foods. We have more of a free market in clothing and in food, in many other areas like that.
Right.
But not in infrastructure.
Anything that is very visible to visible, then government loves to regulate it. For example, it's pretty difficult for you and me, Michael, to go out and build ourselves a power plant and supply electricity to people.
Uh-huh.
So government
or start a bank actually
or start a bank in my profession start
yeah.
a bank. We have to get a license to do that,
uh-huh.
a charter they call it.
Uh-huh.
But let's just say it's a electric power generation. This is one of the commanding heights of the economy. And you can imagine how this electricity is the lifeblood of a industrial economy. So naturally, the government is going to regulate it. And right now, we've seen what happens in the absence of regulation in a critical area of our economy. Fortunately, the government has kept its hands out of the computer industry.
Mm-hmm.
And
televisions,
well, the computers that we
mm-hmm.
all use.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I'm old enough now to remember when a computer was this gigantic thing that was in an air-conditioned room in a bank, and the floor was raised because there was piping under it.
Right.
And we now know that that computer could do no more calculations than probably what you're holding in your hand as your iPod now or whatever
wow,
it happens to
wow.
be.
Yep.
And none of those things would have been if the government had regulated the computer market. Then mm-hmm. we would have had the government saying, well, we've got to limit competition so that IBM and Burroughs and Sperry Rand and companies you've never really heard of.
To protect now. Them.
We've got to protect them because
mm-hmm.
they have a lot of interest. They have a lot of investment in their business.
Which a lot of them are out of business completely.
Yeah, NCR.
Sure.
You don't really hear of any of these companies
Honeywell.
Anymore. Honeywell. Exactly.
Yeah.
IBM's about the only one that's still around.
Right, right.
But the personal computer industry, the cell phone industry.
Mm-hmm.
Thank God that the cell phone industry is not regulated.
Well, there's eBay, there's LASIK surgery, there's plastic surgery, there's the whole electronic area, you know. There's also, we mentioned food and clothing. There's several areas that are either more free market or almost entirely free market, and consumers seem to get a double benefit from this.
Yeah.
One is lower prices, and the other is increasingly exciting number of choices.
Oh, just look at the cell phone. I mean, I feel like I'm in the dark ages because my cell phone only allows me to make a phone call. I can't take a picture with it, and I'm really not that interested in doing that. But I'm probably the last of my friends who can't at least take a picture with a cell phone.
Right.
And now you see on TV all the wonderful, they call them apps, which stands for applications, that you can do on your cell phone. It's just miraculous.
Well, the iPhone has 85,000 applications available to it, and some of them are just absolutely amazing. Well, folks, we're going to be taking a quick break, so we're going to wrap this particular segment up, and we'll be back in just a couple of minutes. This is Radio Free Market. I'm your host, Michael McKay. I'm talking with Mr. Patrick Barron, and we're going to discuss some of the basics about money when we get back. Stay with us. We'll be back in just a minute. And we're back. This is Radio Free Market, and I'm your host, Michael McKay, and I'm talking today with Mr. Patrick Barron, and we're talking about personal responsibility, freedom, and money. And, Pat, we're going to talk now, we're going to change gears a little bit, and why do we even need money? Let's talk about some of these real basic issues. Let's get some of our listeners who are still trying to learn about money and economics some basic compass points for themselves. Why do we even need money? I remember Star Trek, Gene Roddenberry, he wrote the entire series where they didn't even have money in their series. But in the real world, why do we need it?
It's really a great question. It gets to the very heart of a market economy. And it really gets to the very heart of why we have all the wonderful things that we even have today. If we did not have money, then we would revert back to what's called a barter economy.
Mm-hmm.
Money is...
And barter is basically just trading things.
Yeah, it's just trading things. I grow apples, you grow oranges.
Mm-hmm. I got meat in my fridge. You can fix my car.
Right. And if I want something that you have, I have to. If I have apples and I'm an apple grower, and I need someone to come and roof my house, well, I have to find someone who is willing to roof my house and take apples in return.
That's called a coincidence of needs.
That's a double coincidence of needs.
Double coincidence of needs and wants
because the guy who roofs houses has to say, gee, I need apples, and the guy who has apples says, gee, I need my house with the new roof on it.
Mm-hmm.
And that isn't going to happen very much.
Right.
So you realize quickly that civilization, the economy, would not progress very far.
It basically means that we live on a subsistence level.
Yes.
Yeah.
Right. And probably the best example of this would be how the North American Indians traded with one another.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the tribes did trade
mm-hmm.
with one another, but they traded at a very low level.
Mm-hmm.
You know, maybe fish for pelts and vice versa,
mm-hmm.
things like
mm-hmm.
this. So in order to expand the division of labor, we have to have a commodity that is useful for lots of things that a lot of people want.
Mm-hmm.
And this is what money becomes. Now, so we have what's called indirect exchange.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm the apple grower, and you're a guy who roofs houses, Michael. And we both realize that, you know, there are some commodities that everybody wants. And, you know, in different societies, those are different things. But over the years and over the eons, gold and silver have always been desired by everyone.
Mm-hmm.
So even people say, well, I don't really want to own gold and silver, will realize that, well, I'll trade my apples for gold,
mm-hmm.
and then I'll use that gold later on to walk over to visit Michael's office and see if he'll we can strike a deal for him to roof my house for a certain amount of gold. And this is how money arises. Money arises spontaneously out of the market. No one dictates this. It's impossible for anyone to dictate what would be used as money. This is a fallacy.
So nobody really determines what the society uses as a money. It comes out of the market itself.
Yes, and even people today say, well, the government dictates that we use the dollar, but that's because the dollar has a very long history of being used, and the dollar did arise out of the market. It's impossible for anyone to come in and say, I'm going to force everyone to use this new kind of money, and we're going to call it a McKay in honor of you, Michael.
Well, thank you.
And so here I am. I'm the all-powerful dictator, and we're no longer going to use whatever we're using in society, a dollar or a pound or a yen, whatever the case may be, or it's going to be a McKay. Well, what would I have to do? I would have to go around and determine just arbitrarily what everything costs in McKay's. How would I do this? I would have no idea what a computer should cost, what a chair should cost, what a car should cost, what a loaf of bread should cost in terms of this new McKay. But this is exactly what arises through the market process spontaneously over time. The unit of exchange, the indirect unit of exchange, and let's just say it's gold or silver. Over time, there are relationships established between gold and every other commodity and service in the society. And so we realize after a while that a loaf of bread sells for an ounce of gold, or a car would sell for 300 ounces of gold, or as the case may be. And these are always changing in relation to gold itself. But this is a spontaneous thing, and it's impossible for anyone for it to arise otherwise. But this is a very, very important point, is that money itself is a commodity. Money itself is part and parcel of the market economy. It is not something that is added on artificially to the economy. When we do this, this is what we're doing today. We have lots of economic disruptions in the economy. We cause unemployment. We cause shortages. We cause all kinds of problems when we do this. So this is why we Austrians say money must be a market force in the economy, and it should be produced privately.
So we're going to talk about this more when we get back, about whether a country needs more than one money, and whether the government must exclude all others. This is Radio Free Market. Please stay with us. We're going to be back right after the break, folks. So this is Michael McKay, Radio Free Market. Talk to you in just a couple of minutes. And welcome back, folks. This is Radio Free Market, and I'm your host, Michael McKay, and I'm talking with Pat Barron, and we are talking about personal responsibility, freedom, and money. And Pat, you were just talking about how money evolves in a society. And I asked this question: doesn't a country need just one money, and therefore the government must exclude all others?
No, it does not. A government may require that its taxes, for example, be paid in a certain kind of money. For example, I'll give you an example. Last year, my wife and I took a riverboat cruise in Europe. And we went through four or five countries. Some of those countries, you could use different currencies for buying just ordinary things. For example, Slovakia has not yet converted to the euro. They're kind of on the track to do that, but they're not there yet. So they had their own currency, and that was really rather annoying for us tourists, because we would have to exchange some money to get a few little whatever their unit of currency was. But we found out that when we walked into a restaurant or a department store or a bar, there were two prices. There was a price in local currency, and there were a price in euros. So the real market, the people that are running the real economy, had already converted over to euros. And the interesting thing was they knew exactly how many euros would equate to how many, whatever the Slovak currency was. I can't remember it now.
So having more than one money in operation at the same time is not really a problem.
Not a problem at all.
And in fact, actually, folks, I'll tell you that there is an essay on our website at radiofreemarket.com under the education section. And the essay I wrote is called Monetary Ignorance Equals You Are at Risk. And there's a reference to an article that you can find on the internet, which will outline the multiple different currencies that were operating at the same time during the pre-revolutionary period of North America. Mm-hmm. And we got along just fine with that. So let's talk a little bit about prices. You know, in talking about basics, money is one thing. Prices is another very, very important concept. And I always like to link the concept of prices to choices. But I wanted to throw the ball to you, Pat, and talk about how, you know, if you would, how prices are really the language of the market.
Well, prices really are what balances supply and demand. When we as a society decide that we have a higher demand for a certain good, and we see this every day now, especially in the demand for electronic goods. This has been going on now for the last 20 years. So it's always easy to use electronic goods as an example. When electronic goods are first introduced, the newest ones are very expensive. Mm-hmm. And then, but people desire them. Mm-hmm. But it's, you know, it's only a certain few people that are at the cutting edge desire them. But after a while, everyone starts to see the benefit of these new devices. So they start bidding up the price. Mm-hmm. Ah, but this brings more entrepreneurs into the market because the price is going up. People are making lots of money. And we read how certain companies are just making lots and lots of money because they're producing iPhones or GPS devices. And then you turn around 6 months later, and those prices have really dropped, and you walk into Costco or Walmart, and there's about 10 different makes in there, and you can pay all kinds of prices for mm-hmm. them, and the prices dropped. So what did that was the fact that because we demanded, through our choice, we demanded these devices, we wanted them, we bid the price up, but that caused other entrepreneurs to see that there was an opportunity, a profit-making opportunity, so they created a bigger supply. Mm-hmm. And as that supply hit the market, the price starts to fall down. Mm-hmm. Now, we see this very quickly in electronic devices now. So you can actually see the market happening. For many things, we don't really realize that this is going on because some of these products that we buy every day are so ubiquitous to us. They're part of daily life. We buy a loaf of bread and we don't really think that a loaf of bread changes price very much, or we buy certain things, but they are changing. Mm-hmm. And especially, for example, a loaf of bread. I forget why I was looking at this, but I was reading a Rothbard book that he wrote in the 60s, mm-hmm. and he was using an example of a loaf of bread that cost 70 cents. Uh-huh. A loaf of bread costs 70 cents.
Right, right.
Sometimes if you go to the grocery store, there might be something on sale for $1.50, but most bread mm-hmm. costs $2.50 to $3.
Right.
But when Rothbard wrote this, bread cost 70 cents. Otherwise, he wouldn't put it in his book.
Right.
So these things do change over time. And we get into another era, another facet of money, which is the facet of inflation. Well, why does bread cost $1.50 to $3 now instead of 70 cents?
Well, I want to talk about this because this is directly related to this whole issue, and we could actually spend quite a bit of time on this, but please explain what inflation is and is not.
Well, most people, when they hear, they say inflation, and I sort of err on this too when I'm just talking to the general public. When you talk about inflation, they think that it's prices.
Uh-huh.
We have inflation when prices are rising. Gasoline goes from $2 to $3, so there is inflation in gasoline prices. But for the Austrians, the Austrians say inflation is inflation of the money supply.
Mm-hmm.
That the general price level, unless there's some kind of crisis in the whole economy, like the nation goes to war, so you stop producing the normal everyday goods. Prices really have no reason to go up because we really are becoming more productive all the time.
Well, let's stop on this point and let's dwell on this for just a second. If productivity is going up all the time, it would stand to reason that the general price level of things should go down.
That's right. So we have to ask ourselves, why does it not go down?
Right.
And the reason is we have inflation in the money supply.
Okay, so there's a difference between money inflation or monetary inflation and price inflation.
Right.
And what is that connection?
Well, the connection is, for example, we have a wonderful connection right now, which appears to be a dislocation, but it really isn't. We have inflation of the money supply, where the Fed has been pumping in excess reserves into the banking system, and the money supply has been expanding, but prices have not been going up. And say, well, why is this? If the money supply is expanding, why are prices not going up? Well, that's because people are just not spending their money.
Let's take this two steps, because you kind of introduced two new ideas in this idea of monetary inflation. There's the government's involved in monetary inflation, and banks are involved in monetary inflation. Mm-hmm. How are they connected to this whole equation?
Yeah, this is a very, very interesting part of economics, and I'll try to make it as clear as I can in a short period of time. But most of the money supply in the nation is the result of bank lending.
Okay, so most of it isn't the dollar bills and coins that we know about. How much of our money supply is really just coins and dollars and bills?
I really don't know what the exact amount
is. Well, I've read it's about, but you know, 5%.
I was going to say 10%.
Yeah, it's actually more in the order of less than 5%.
And we can just think about how we ourselves, you know, we have money in the bank, but we also have some money in our wallets, but we don't carry much money in our wallets.
Right.
Most of our money is in our checking account or our savings account.
So most of them are just digits.
Yeah. They're just digits on our bank account when we get it. And we hope that those digits are going up.
Right.
So how does that happen? Then the banks, we have what's called a fractional reserve banking system.
And okay.
I'll see if I can get...
What are fractional reserves and what are reserves?
Well, reserves are dollars that must be maintained at the Federal Reserve Bank. Each bank has an account at the Fed that is their checking account at the Fed.
Okay, at the Federal Reserve.
At the Fed.
Mm-hmm.
And a checking account that you have at the bank, a certain small portion of that must be kept in dollars at the Fed. We'll just, for simplicity's sake, say that it's 10%.
Mm-hmm.
So if I have $100 in my checking account, then the bank is required to keep $10 of that in its account at the Fed. So if a bank, say, it's a $100 million bank, then it would have to keep $10 million in reserves at the Fed.
Okay.
Okay. So far, so good. Now, how does the money supply expand? Well, the Fed decides that it wants to stimulate the economy. So it pumps reserves into the system, and how it does that is through open market operations, which I don't really want to get into. But it does, and what it does is the banks will find that they now have, instead of a $10 million in the reserve account, they now have, let's say, $20 million, to make it simple, in the reserve account. Well, the reserve requirement is still 10%. So if they have $20 million in reserves, and they have only $100 million in demand deposits in their checking account, they're over-reserved. What that means is that they can make loans of another $100 million.
So when you started this out and you were saying it's a $100 million bank, it's not that the bank has $100 million in it.
No.
It's that the bank had $10 million and made $90 million out of thin air.
Yes.
Okay, so that's how it becomes a $100 million bank. It doesn't become a $100 million bank by starting off with $100 million.
It lends money.
It lends this money into existence.
And the simple way it does this, it's very easy. Mr. Smith walks into the bank and he says, I would like to borrow money for my business or to take a trip or to buy a car. The bank thinks he's a pretty good credit. He can probably pay it back. And it says, all right, I'm putting, let's say, $10,000. I'm putting $10,000 into your checking account. And you sign this note for $10,000 that is the loan. On the bank's books, it has an asset of $10,000, which is the loan.
Uh-huh.
And it has a liability of $10,000, which is the checking account. And you can easily see that neither of those were there before.
I see.
Neither were there before. That $10,000 checking account was just generated out of thin air.
It's just the banker just decided to make it, just to create it. And this is part of what is called the fractional reserve banking system.
Yes. It's a highly unstable system.
You actually referred to this in one of our conversations as a fiat reserves type of system.
Yes.
Why is this so dangerous?
Well, it's so dangerous because the reserves themselves are nothing but fiat money.
Mm-hmm.
And as we see now, what happened, Michael, last fall, just about a year ago, the banking system, generally the banking system has about $2 billion of what are called excess reserves. And this is, banks try not to have any excess reserves. They try to stay fully loaned up.
Okay.
That's how they make their money. But there's, in our huge economy, in our huge banking system, $2 billion of excess reserves is about normal. It's sort of the frictional amount that can't quite be invested every day, sort of like you and I would carry around,
extra money
in your
pocket. Little
extra money in our pocket.
Okay.
We can't quite invest all this because we have to stop and buy
right.
a cup of coffee once in a while.
Right.
Or stop, you know, whatever.
Uh-huh.
So the Fed, you know, the banking system has about $2 billion of excess reserves on and normal, but the government said, the Fed said, well, we want to stimulate the banking system. We now have $800 billion of excess reserves. Think about that. This is unbelievable.
So it's so you go from $2 billion to $800 billion.
And they produce that $800 billion absolutely out of thin air. And the way they did that, Michael,
so that's a 400 time increase.
Our mutual friend Thorsten Polite from in Frankfurt.
Yeah, he's the professor of economics at Frankfurt University of Frankfurt, Germany, I believe.
Yes.
I think it's.
He's
a senior economist at Barclays. Investment firm in Frankfurt, Germany.
Very, very intelligent man. He writes a lot of wonderful articles. He says that we have increased the monetary base, this reserves, by 1,700%.
Jeez.
Now that means that the banking system itself has the capability, once it starts working down these excess reserves, of expanding the money supply exponentially. Now, we're not expanding our economy exponentially.
Mm-hmm.
We're not tripling our economy or quadrupling our economy, much less 1,700%. So this means that we have the possibility of entering hyperinflation in this country, in my opinion.
Mm-hmm. Let's jump ahead and Tell us what is hyperinflation?
Well, hyperinflation means that people just will not hold on to the money for any reason because the purchasing power of the money has dropped to almost nothing.
Mm-hmm.
This has happened, it happened last year in Zimbabwe. We think that this normally happens only in very backward countries that are just too stupid to know how to run their banking system. So it happened in Zimbabwe, where their money dropped, you know, from whatever unit they were using where it cost trillions of those units to buy.
Their money actually is being issued with expiration dates on it.
Yeah, it's just crazy.
Yeah, it's pretty crazy.
But a modern country, roughly 90 years ago, Germany had hyperinflation. This was the first modern industrial country to have hyperinflation. And their money was absolutely destroyed by the Reichsbank. The Reichsbank was the central bank of Germany.
Yeah, there's some excellent literature on that that is starting to come out. The Black Obelisk by Remarque, who wrote All Quiet on the Western Front, I believe, and tells the tragic story of what it was like to live through that, where people just it became basically social chaos and depredation everywhere. Well, we would, you know, I'd like to talk about you know, the next layer on this of why now more than ever. We've kind of bridged into this right now, and we're going to take a break in just a few seconds, folks. And then we're going to talk a little bit more about why now more than ever before having this knowledge for yourself is very important. So please stay with us. We're going to be back in just a couple of minutes. This is Michael McKay, Radio Free Market, and we'll be back right after the break. Welcome back, folks. This is Radio Free Market, and I am your host, Michael McKay, and we're talking with Pat Barron, who's teaching Austrian economics at the University of Iowa. And we're talking about this fascinating topic of personal responsibility, freedom, and money. And we've been going over some of the basics about money that many of us have never learned. And we're going to talk now in this last segment about sound money. So sound money or honest money is a topic. Pat, would you just give us a definition? What is sound money? What are we talking about?
Well, sound money is money that is a result of the market. It is always backed by some commodity of lasting value, and we can just assume that that would be gold or silver. It is money that is owned by the people. It's not owned by the government. And so if government wants money, it must come to the people to get it.
Okay.
And I think this is one of the most important features of sound money, is that it changes the entire relationship between the people and their government.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas right now, the government really has made many people in our country and in the world dependent upon itself because it can manufacture money.
Mm-hmm.
So we feel that if we want something, we have to go to the government to get it because they have the money.
Mm-hmm.
Under a sound money regime, the government has to come to the people for the money.
So you mentioned in the break that you thought that sound money is the most important economic issue of all time.
Yes.
So would you explain that a little bit further for us?
Well, I'll just read a quote. This is one of my favorite quotes by Ludwig von Mises. I have it right here, and this is from his first great book, the book that made him really famous, written in 1912.
Okay.
A book called The Theory of Money and Credit.
Mm-hmm.
And von Mises says, it is impossible to grasp the meaning of the idea of sound money if one does not realize that it was devised as an instrument for the protection of civil liberties against despotic inroads on the part of governments. Ideologically, it belongs in the same class with political constitutions and bills of rights. And I believe that what Mises meant by this, and I have read the theory of money and credit, is that the people are supreme when they have the money. When we have, the government can get out of line, but it can't get out of line very far because the people will just refuse to give it its money.
Mm-hmm.
We will refuse. There will be a tax revolt if they try to tax us and take it from us at the point of a gun. Or if they say, well, we'll borrow from you, say, well, fine. But eventually, we will not accept the government's notes, and interest rates will go very high, and the government will not be able to finance its operations. In other words, the people, if we have the money, then government has to do our bidding for us to a certain extent.
So the old adage of the answer to 99 questions is money,
yes,
really is the answer to many of our problems is,
yes,
honest and sound money. So how do we convert to that? How would the U.S. convert to a sound monetary system from where it is right now? We have about a minute to try to get through that topic.
Well, actually, there are many different theories about how to do this, many different techniques, but they all involve tying the existing amount of money to gold mm-hmm. that the government does own. Mm-hmm. It would be to tie the dollar to gold. We also would probably want to eliminate the legal tender laws that prevent other kinds of currency from circulating. So if we did not want to use the dollar because we didn't trust it, we could use the euro, we could use the yen.
And things could be priced in more than one money.
Yes, we could do that. In other words, the people would finally get control of their money, and we would have our own economy, and the government keep its grubby little hands out of it.
Mm-hmm.
And eventually, we would have a private money supply.
We only have about another 30 seconds, so we're not going to be able to go into even another question. So, Pat, I want to thank you very much for taking the time today. Folks, we're going to get Pat Barron back on this show again in the not-too-distant future, and we're going to talk more about money and getting ourselves educated in economics. In the meantime, please formulate your questions and send them to us at radiofreemarket.com, and look at our website, radiofreemarket.com. Get educated about this very important issue. We have some wonderful resources there. Thank you.